This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Thanks for tuning in today. I've got a good show lined up for you today. Joining me just momentarily for an economic update will be Mr. Carl Denninger. And also joining me on today's program will be economist Joel Naroff. We'll get Mr. Naroff's take on where we are economically speaking. And as always, we'll talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for you and your money. Before I get to my conversation with Mr. Denninger, let me remind everyone of a couple of educational resources we have available for you. We here at the Everything Financial Radio Program are all about education, so we do make some resources available to you. The first is a free newsletter titled Portfolio Watch that I publish every week. If you would like to get a free subscription to Portfolio Watch, it's very easy to do so. All you have to do is go to the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourretirementoutlook.com. And we'll be glad to sign you up to get your free subscription. We also have coming up on October the 27th and October the 29th, some Social Security maximization dinner workshops. These meetings begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. and we serve a complimentary dinner. You can get more information on that resource by visiting the website socialsecuritydinner.com. The website, again, is socialsecuritydinner.com. And I'd also encourage you to check out our new retirement rules class. This is our most comprehensive educational resource. There is a nominal cost for this to cover the cost of books, handouts, and lunch. It's $49. The class, it will be held coming up on the 24th of October, begins at 9 a.m., concludes at 2:30 p.m. You can get more information at the website, newretirementrules.com. The website, again, to get more information, newretirementrules.com. And please, if you've already attended, please do not register. Give someone who hasn't yet attended an opportunity to attend. I am pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio Program one of my favorite guests, Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl is a prolific writer. You can read his work at market-ticker.org, rather. And Carl, thanks for being back on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. Always appreciate it.
You know, Carl, you wrote a few days ago about the heading of your piece was the word starts with a D, and you had some facts in here that I thought, as part of this piece, which we'll simply call Economic Update with Carl Denninger, I thought that the listeners should know about. You started by talking about housing disposable income, and you said that's the amount the average family can spend on housing has fallen 26% over the space of 10 years. That's a statistic that we just don't hear. Explain.
Well, of course you don't hear it because nobody wants to talk about that. If we have that discussion, then the, you know, the stock market and everything related to it goes in the toilet immediately. But it's the truth. And here's the math behind it. Nobody buys houses, they buy payments. Okay, it's the same thing that happens with cars. Very few people buy a car and pay cash. Most of them, you know, finance their purchase just like you finance your house. So the Federal Reserve published this thing, they tweeted it, which is the average 30-year mortgage rate over the last 10 years. And there's all this data that you can get off of this system called FRED that has this. And every now and then they put out a tweet that highlights something. And the astounding little fact there was the drop in interest rates over that 10-year period in time. So if you have a HP-12C, which is the, you know, kind of the financial calculator of record, if you will, that nice little device will allow you to produce the principal value of a note given an interest rate and a term. So from this, you can say, well, if I have $2,000 a month to spend on a house and the interest rate is X, what is my payment? Okay? And it will give you that number. That's something that everybody, you know, you can call up any mortgage broker and they'll give you that figure. But there's another kind of interesting thing, too, that you can do. You can say, well, if I have this much money to spend and the interest rate is Y, what is the principal value of the note? In other words, how much house can I buy? All right, which is the opposite, all right? You know, it's not what is the payment on this? It's what's the principle that that represents? And so what I did was I went back and I looked at this, given the National Association of Realtors house value numbers, which are approximately back to where they were in 2006, just before the crash. And what that number tells us is that because of the decline in interest rates, the average family looking to buy a house has 26% less money available to buy a house with today than they had in 2006.
Wow. And Carl, let's talk about another economic fact here also. You'd mentioned, and I may be paraphrasing a bit, so please correct me if this is not what your intent was when you wrote the piece, but you said we've really replaced soup kitchens, which were very prevalent during the Great Depression, with a prepaid debit card. And these prepaid debit cards not only work at the grocery store, they work at the liquor store, and you had quite a few comments. Can you comment again for our listeners?
Yeah, there's this general perception that we should avoid the idea or the premise that somebody who is on public assistance of any sort should have to subject themselves to any kind of shame in order to use it. In other words, there's something dirty about having to stand in line to get your plate filled. And so there was a lot of fraud with the food coupons that used to be handed out, the traditional food stamps. So what we do now is we give you what looks like and spends like and works like a debit card. And those are supposed to be restricted in some cases. Some of the money that's put on there is not supposed to be able to be used for, you know, other than foodstuffs. But there are ways around that, and one of them, of course, is that you buy somebody else's steaks and they buy your booze.
So the old barter system, yeah.
Yeah, there's a little barter game that goes on there. But then there's other forms of public assistance that have no constraints on them at all. You can actually take those funds off those cards at an ATM at a casino if you want to. And all of that typically ends up on one card. So there is some kind of mismatching and matching that goes on. But remember that money is fungible. So, you know, a $20 bill is a $20 bill is a $20 bill. And although certain parts of it are restricted, you just buy things in the right order so that you get what you want. And the problem with this sort of a paradigm is that it hides the true cost that these programs have and allows them to be funded through deficit spending. But the problem with doing that is that that's just taking the same money out of your pocket. You see, when you fund something through deficit spending, what you're doing is taxing people because you're diluting the value of everything they own. So we are not really, you know, the idea is, well, we don't have to raise taxes to pay for these programs. Well, yes, you are raising taxes to pay for these programs. You're just doing it by lying.
Well, our guest today has been Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl, appreciate that update. We've got about 1 minute left in this segment. Let me just ask very quickly, based on this short conversation we've had, are you predicting that the U.S. will officially fall back to recession soon?
Well, I think we already have. It's, you know, the official definition is, of course, you know, 2 quarters of negative economic expansion, right? But if you take a look at the actual progress that people have made, such as it is, it's been negative for the last 10 years. So, I mean, how can you have the disposable income? Look at the retail sales report, just the one that just came out. It's less than 1% annualized growth ex autos. And that's with a huge drop in gasoline expense. It didn't go back into the rest of the economy. People just don't have any money to spend.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest has been Mr. Carl Denninger. I would encourage you to check out his very prolific writing at market-ticker.org. Carl, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. Before I get to my conversation with another one of my guest experts this week, Mr. Joel Neroff, I'd like to remind you of a couple of free resources we have available. The first is our new retirement rules class. The new retirement rules class will be held on October 24th at the Grand Rapids campus of Western Michigan University. You can get more information on the class by visiting the website newretirementrules.com. We talk about economic outcomes, we talk about economic consequences, and we talk about how your retirement might be affected. When you leave the class, you have a terrific resource that we believe will be very helpful in the years to come. The class begins at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, the 24th, and concludes at 2:30 p.m. Again, you can get more information at the website, newretirementrules.com. I am pleased to have back on the program Joel L. Neroff. Mr. Neroff is the president and founder of Neroff Economic Advisors, a strategic economic consulting firm. He's actually also the author of Big Picture Economics, How to Navigate the New Global Economy. I would encourage you to check that out. It's available at Amazon and at bookstores everywhere. And Joel, welcome back to the program.
Dennis, thanks for having me.
Joel, let me start by just talking a bit about the Federal Reserve's monetary policy. There's been talk since really the beginning of the year that the Fed will begin to raise interest rates. They haven't done that. Why do you think that is?
Well, one forecast that economists have been consistently wrong on is the forecast that the Fed was going to raise interest rates. And you know, the question we have is, why haven't they? If you really think about it, they got down to these 0% rates when we were in a crisis, when the economy had was collapsing, when the financial system was teetering on the edge. The Fed did everything it could to get things going. One of them was to drop rates to the lowest level they possibly could. Well, the crisis is over. The economy's growing, decently. It may not be robust. We had a great second quarter growth. It'll be less in the summer. But the economy's growing consistently. The unemployment rate is way down. People are buying cars. It looks like this economy is coming back, but the Fed keeps saying that they don't want to raise rates just yet. I think the reason is that they're fearful. They're fearful about raising rates too soon. If you think about it, the worst thing that happens if they don't raise rates is we get some extra inflation next year or the year after. If they raise it too soon, the economy could falter, and then what do they do? So I think it's really out of excessive concern that increasing interest rates could squash this relatively moderate recovery, and that's why they're being so cautious right now.
And Joel, it seems like when you look at the data that deflation may actually be more of a threat than inflation presently. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I don't think we're going to, be risking deflation that much. Clearly the inflation rate is well below what we expected. And the Fed would like it at 2%, and it's half of that rate. One of the biggest reasons for that is a lot of input prices, commodities, especially oil prices, have collapsed. But as we go through the next 6 months, we're going to see that those declines from the end of last year and the beginning of this year will disappear. Don't be surprised if the inflation rate moves upwards, not because energy prices are rising, but we've got down to these low levels last spring or even earlier, and we won't be seeing the increases, the decreases anymore. So, while the inflation rate's low, deflation's not an issue. On the other hand, we're not seeing any acceleration, so we're kind of stuck in this really low inflation environment.
Joel, I've had guests on the program who have said that the Fed will likely not raise rates for at least 6 months, and other guests have even gone so far as to say that the economy will continue to weaken and the Fed will be forced into another quantitative easing or money printing program. What would your take be on an opinion like that?
Well, I've heard that. The old saying, if you put two economists in the room, you'll probably have at least three or four different opinions. And so it's good to debate the alternatives. My view is that the economy is fundamentally sound, especially the domestic U.S. economy. If you really look at it, we've had vehicle sales near record highs in the last few months. Consumers are buying cars. Housing starts are beginning to pick up. Housing prices are rising. home sales are increasing. The consumer is buying lots of things. If you're running a restaurant, the gains have been really, really good because people are eating out again. So if you look at consumers, they're in good shape. If you look at businesses, except of course for the oil patch, which is hurting, you know, that's for certain. You know, businesses are investing. Their earnings are reasonably good, at least in the U.S. So the fundamental U.S. economy is solid. You know, if you're looking at it as far as the equity markets are concerned, the problem with earnings, as far as companies are concerned, come from the international companies. You know, they're having problems because the international economy is slowing and the dollar's strong, and that lowers their earnings. But if you just look at the U.S. economy, the labor market is tight, wage gains are beginning to accelerate, consumers have the money, there's no reason to think that we couldn't have decent, if not stronger, growth as we go through 2016 because of that. So I'm not in that camp. I'm in the camp that the economy is already strong enough that it could absorb, you know, a rate increase. Remember, we'd be going from less than 25 basis points to less than 50 basis points, from a quarter of a point to a half a point, and that's not a high rate by any means. It shouldn't hurt anything.
Yeah, let me go back, if I could, and just get your take on something, Joel. When you talk about the fact that home sales are up and car sales are up, there are many that would point to the fact that most of those purchases are driven by credit. People borrow money to make those purchases, and although we've gone through some amount of deleveraging since the financial crisis, there's not much room left on the credit card. Would you be in agreement that private sector debt levels are now once again reaching capacity and that will be a drag moving ahead, or do you think there's some room left there?
Oh, I think that there's plenty of room left there. You know, if you take a look at what happened, we went through, really starting about 2008 until about 2013, even into 2014, where the consumer was deleveraging. They really weren't buying a whole lot. They were being extremely cautious, and so they got their balance sheets into really good shape. In addition, while they're buying more homes and they're buying more SUVs, you know, the loan rates are really low, so their carrying costs are not nearly what they would have been at more normal levels of interest rates. So yes, they are beginning to take on debt again. But we don't have irrational consumers right now. They learned a real big lesson from the Great Recession. That's, you don't buy things unless you can afford them. And we're not seeing really excessive borrowing at this point as far as, you know, the household sector is concerned.
And we have time for one more question in this segment, Joel. You'd mentioned that the labor market is fairly tight. I think the headline unemployment rate's at 5.1% as we talk here. The labor force participation rate, though, is at about 62%, which is near, I think, about nearly a 40-year low. How would you square that?
If you take a look at what's happening, there's a lot of debate about the labor force participation rate. I think we need to first understand that the labor force participation rate peaked 15 and a half years ago. So this is not a new trend. It's been going on for 15 years. And so it's not a result of this weak recovery or even the Great Recession. It was happening, you know, 7-8 years beforehand. So, you know, that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing is that there's a lot of demographics that are at work here. You know, baby boomers are retiring. Millennials are coming in. They're not supplying their labor at quite the same rate as other groups had. So we have a situation where while the labor force participation rate is going down, none of us really know what the labor force participation rate should be. You know, it skyrocketed in the 80s and 90s as the boomers really got into the market. It's coming down as the boomers get out of the labor market. You know, where we should be is unclear at this particular point. It's probably a little lower than it will be in the next few years. But really, over the year, it only dropped 0.3%. So it stopped, you know, for the most part, it stopped going down. So I'm not really greatly worried about that point. Yeah, we have some excess labor. People want, you know, full-time jobs, and they can only get part-time jobs. But the labor market is clearly tightening, and we're beginning to see that as the number of job openings hit record high. That's the key sign that there's not enough workers out there.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Mr. Joel Neroff. He's the author of Big Picture Economics, How to Navigate the New Global Economy. I'd encourage you to check it out. And we'll continue our conversation with Joel when Everything Financial Radio continues. Stay with us.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. My guest today, returning guest, I should say, is Joel Neroff. Joel is the president and founder of Neroff Economic Advisors, a strategic economic consulting firm. He is also the author of the book, Big Picture Economics, How to Navigate the New Global Economy. I would encourage you to check it out. And Joel, we were talking a bit in the last segment, before we ran out of time, about the effect that demographics has had on the labor force participation rate, with the boomers now retiring. In fact, I think I read somewhere that there are 10,000 65th birthday parties a day now in the United States, which is mind-boggling when you think about it. What effect will these changing demographics have on economic growth moving ahead?
Well, clearly, we are having and going through a changeover. Where the boomers, which had really controlled this economy for the last 40 years, you know, even longer, 50 years, are now beginning to move out. They are, as they retire, their spending patterns will change, and they have a fair amount of wealth, to say the least, that's spendable. And what's coming in behind them is the millennials, who are a very, very different generation than the boomers. So what we have is this changeover. You know, within the decade, millennials will make up something like 50%, or almost 50% of the labor force. And so that's the group that will really start controlling the economy in terms of income growth. That's, you know, if you look at the distribution of income and where incomes are growing, it's in that younger generation. That's the group that's getting a lot of the wage increases at this point. They're going to have the spending power. They're the ones who are going to be buying the homes. They're the really key demographic. So we're having a tremendous demographic switch, changeover from the baby boomers to the millennials, and it will change the pattern of spending, the way homes are built and sold, and really almost everything that goes on. And what's going to be key in the future is how millennials form households. With all the debt that they've had and their hesitation to form households, once they start doing it, that's going to really kick the economy into another gear. Because once you have a household, your spending patterns really do change dramatically.
So, Joel, as far as timing for this this economic jumpstart from the millennials, give our listeners an idea as to when you think this is going to happen.
Well, it's a slow process, but it's going to happen within this decade. This is when the millennials really start piling into the workforce, and at the same time, you know, as you commented, when you're talking about so many boomers hitting 65, and 10 years from now, most of those people will be retired and really throttling back on their spending habits, we're going to start seeing it really begin to accelerate over the next 5 years. And 5 years out, that's really going to be when it's clear that the spending shift has moved over to the millennials. So whether it's in the workforce or whether it's, you know, you're a business person, that's the target group that you have to have in your mind starting now, because they're going to be controlling our spending power for decades to come.
So, Joel, let's go back and revisit the idea of interest rates rising. If the Fed were to decide, you know, as they likely will at some point, to do some type of an interest rate increase, How will our listeners be affected? How will that affect mortgage rates and the cost of borrowing?
Well, I think the first thing we got to recognize is the Fed's policies affect shorter-term rates. And, you know, to the extent if you have something like a variable-rate mortgage, and that's linked to, let's say, the prime rate, when the Fed's funds rate goes up, banks usually change their prime rate accordingly. So you may actually see your variable rate mortgages begin to rise as a result of that. If you're going out to get a new home and take out a new mortgage, that's really the longer end of the market. And the market's going to have to determine whether the rise in rates is a signal that the economy's strong and therefore inflation is going to start picking up. If the markets take it as such, they're going to start moving up longer-term rates. So if you go out and try to get a new mortgage, for example, you're going to see mortgage rates begin to rise. But I think the key thing to keep in mind is that the Fed has made it clear it's not going to raise rates rapidly. They meet eight times a year, and they're not going to raise rates at least for the first 6 or 9 months at every meeting. So they may raise rates 25 basis points, a quarter of a percentage point, every 3 months maybe. That's not a lot. Over the course of 2016, maybe 1 percentage point, no more than 1.5 percentage points over the course of 1 year. Now, that affects you, but it's not going to be a huge impact. However, if you're sensitive to the rise in things such as mortgage rates, then the idea that mortgage rates are going to stay where they are and you can take all the time you want to buy a home, well, you got to change your thinking. And indeed, I've made a little argument that a rise in rates would actually help the housing market, because all those people who have been sitting on the fence saying, I've got plenty of time to look, they're suddenly going to discover they don't have that much time. They're going to have to make decisions. But rates are going to go up, but they're going to go up slowly over the course of 2016. The only thing that would change that is if inflation really picks up, and right now that doesn't appear to be the case.
Well, if you're just joining us, our guest today is Mr. Joel Nerhoff. He's the author of Big Picture Economics, How to Navigate the New Global Economy. Joel, let me go back and visit a topic that we talked about on our program last week. And that is the level of derivative exposure among the big banks, which is significantly higher than it was prior to the financial crisis. What's your take on this level of derivative exposure, and what, in your mind, in your view, would be the probability of a repeat of the financial crisis due to this high level of derivative exposure?
Well, there is this exposure to, you know, derivatives, and, you know, if you are worried about the strength of the financial sector, that's one of the things you always look at. Dodd-Frank and the way they have to isolate some of those investments as far as the bank is concerned and their investment has really changed very, very much the riskiness of these kinds of investments. They're looked at in different ways. They're handled in different ways. And I think so far, you know, the Fed is doing, and the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, the regulators are doing a pretty good job of staying on top of it in terms of understanding the risk that these investments have. Is it a major concern? You always are worried when, you know, the derivative products, you know, exposure becomes really high, because we've seen the problems that have been created in the past. But it is to some extent a very, very different regulatory world, where the regulators have the power and the capacity to really come down if they view it as risky. And, you know, after the calamity we had, that they're not going to be willing to say, oh, gee, you know, we let them get away with it. They let them get away with a lot of risky decisions in the last decade. I think the Fed and the regulators are doing a reasonably good job of understanding the risks and limiting them as much as possible.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Joel Naroff. He's the author of Big Picture Economics, How to Navigate the New Global Economy. I'd encourage you to check it out. Joel, thanks so much for coming back on the program. Enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to being back sometime in the future.
Love to have you. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. And before I get to this segment, which I'm simply going to title Economic Outcomes, and I'm going to keep potential economic outcomes from here and what we might experience very simple, I would like to take a moment and just thank our special guests that were kind enough to join us on today's program, Mr. Carl Denninger for his economic update, and Mr. Naroff also for joining us on today's program. Now, as I said, I want to talk about economic outcomes, and as many of you know, if you've been a long-time listener to the program, we believe that money and currencies cycle, we believe that economies cycle, and we believe that certain economic patterns have repeated themselves time and time again historically, and by just studying history, we can have a pretty good idea, in our view, as to where things go from here. Now, in this segment, I want to talk about a couple very simple economic concepts, and yet they are misunderstood, in my experience, by most folks and by many in the financial industry. What I want to talk about are simply the concepts of inflation and deflation. Now, if I were to define inflation, many of you would probably say the definition of inflation would be rising prices, but that's not really the most accurate definition of inflation. Inflation is really an expansion of the money supply. One of the symptoms of an expansion of the money supply is that consumer prices tend to go up. Deflation is simply the polar opposite of inflation. Deflation is a contraction of the money supply. Now, when you talk about inflation, if inflation is an expansion of the money supply, the first question that comes to mind is, how does the money supply expand? Well, the first way that the money supply expands is by money moving. See, the banking system model that's used throughout the world and in virtually every country, to my knowledge, is something called the fractionalized banking system. And the fractionalized banking system is a system that requires bankers to keep a certain percentage of assets that you deposit in the bank in reserve. Now, the most common reserve requirement and that used in the United States today is a reserve rate of 10%. So if you go put $10,000 into your bank, your banker has to reserve $1,000 but can loan out the other $9,000. If the banker loans out $9,000 to someone who wants to buy a used car, then that particular customer can borrow the $9,000 from the bank, go to the car lot, give the $9,000 to the car dealer, who goes and deposits the $9,000 in their bank account, and that banker has to reserve $900 and can loan out the other $8,100. Now, that process continues, and the more money moves, the more money that is created. Well, how do you make money move faster? I mean, if you have a really slow economy and you want money to move faster, you want more money to be moving around and try to get people to borrow money, that's how money moves, then what you want to do is reduce interest rates. And conversely, if interest rates are really high and if inflation is really high, you want to raise interest rates so money doesn't move around as quickly. You want to make money move more slowly. That's what happened back in the late 70s and early 80s when Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker increased interest rates to a very high level. Many of you listening to this may be old enough to remember what happened. Well, what happened? Inflation did subside, and then the economy recovered. Now, interest rates have been at zero really since the financial crisis, and in our view, the economy's not getting noticeably better. In my new retirement rules class that I teach, and as I talk to many listeners of the radio program, many of you feel the same way. Well, money is not really moving, and the simple reason is that debt levels are simply too high. If interest rates are zero, but you can't afford another payment, it really doesn't matter that interest rates are zero. Now let's look at the other side of that coin. How does the money supply contract? The money supply contracts when money disappears from the financial system, and that happens when people default on debt. A really important statistic to remember is that 95% of today's money is debt. Less than 5% is currency. So if 95% of money is debt and there's too much debt today to be paid, and as we talk about in our New Retirement Rules class, and as I mentioned in my book, New Retirement Rules, debt levels today in the private sector are 50% greater than they were at the beginning of the Great Depression. So there is a lot of debt. Well, if someone defaults on debt, meaning they simply say, I can't afford to pay it, I'm going to walk away, that's how money disappears from the financial system, and that's how deflation kicks in. Now, we've used the term quantitative easing. We've used the term to describe what the Federal Reserve has been doing on and off, and essentially that means money printing. So why is the Federal Reserve engaging in this rather aggressive, if you will, policy? Well, number one, to avoid deflation. If you can add money to the system faster than money is removed from the system through defaults on debt, you don't get deflation. You create, hopefully, modest inflation. Secondly, the Fed may have no other alternative. I mean, if you look at different ways that the deficit and debt can be addressed, there's only three ways that it can be addressed from a monetary perspective. Number one, taxes could be raised. In the book New Retirement Rules, I point out that this is going to be mathematically impossible. Number two, spending could be cut, which does create a great amount of economic pain. Or, as an alternative to raising taxes or cutting spending, you might find that money could be printed. Now, Thomas Jefferson understood this very, very well. Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States, said, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. So first by inflation, then by deflation, this problem will be created. Well, what did Jefferson mean by that? Well, Jefferson understood that there's really only three ways to address a deficit. You can raise taxes, cut spending, or print money. And if you give a private bank the power to print money, that private bank will indeed print money. And they will print money until a currency is compromised or destroyed. And then deflation sets in because one of the reasons money is printed in the first place is to deal with debt excesses. When you print money, debt doesn't go away, and when you destroy a currency, you actually have debt that is re-denominated. Now, let me give you just one example. This pattern has repeated itself historically many times, but let me give you a recent example, and I've got an article from the East African from September 28th, and the title of the article is Zimbabwe from Hyperinflation to Deflation, and it illustrates the point that Jefferson was making very, very keenly. And I'll give you just a bit from this article. Since 2005, Clemens Mujeru has been supporting his family from his secondhand clothes business in Zimbabwe. When business was good, he bought a piece of land to build a house in one of the capital suburbs. Mr. Mujeru was admired in the neighborhood, but not so much anymore. Things are not working out the way they used to, said Mujeru, who used the proceeds from the street sales to pay school fees for his three children. The situation, Mr. Mujeru says, is getting worse. 2 weeks ago, he said, the municipal police came around and took away all his wares. They said, we are not allowed to sell secondhand clothes, something I've been doing for the last 20 years. Besides the battles with the law enforcement officers, it's become harder for Mujeru to sell his wares because his longtime customers can no longer afford them. I used to sell merchandise worth at least $50 a day at the beginning of the year, but these days I would be very lucky to get $10, he said. People do not have money, he said, adding that some of his regular customers have been retrenched from employment, while others go for several months without receiving their salaries. With hundreds of workers losing their jobs every day, the informal sector had become a reliable alternative for Mujeru and thousands of other Zimbabweans. The government in July banned the importation of secondhand clothes, citing health concerns, and throwing the future of thousands of informal traders into doubt. The government was under pressure to contain the ballooning import bill blamed on the collapse of local industries. Around the same time, an onslaught was launched against informal traders like Mujeru, who had flocked to the central business districts of towns across the country because of the rampant unemployment. Now, millions of Zimbabweans are disillusioned by the economic crisis, which reached its peak in 2008 with hyperinflation topping 500%. There was a brief reprieve in 2009 when the country abandoned its battered dollar and adopted a basket of currencies, which concluded, among other currencies, the U.S. dollar and the South African rand. But the wheels began to come off again in 2013 when the country held another round of controversial elections. The economy stagnated, companies closed shop, and a landmark Supreme Court labor ruling saw companies shedding a staggering 20,000 jobs in 3 weeks. Zimbabweans were now facing a new scourge, deflation, which economists say is worse than hyperinflation. Consumer prices have been falling every month since the beginning of 2014, but this has not been any reason to celebrate for crisis-weary Zimbabweans. Analysts say deflation has discouraged spending, leading to falling wages, rising unemployment, and stagnation in economic growth. The competitiveness of local industries has also been eroded, as imports ranging from clothes to food have become cheaper. John Robertson, an independent economist in one of his publications, said that deflation was as bad as hyperinflation, if not worse. So what did we see happen in Zimbabwe? Well, if we go back to the Thomas Jefferson quote, he said that first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property. Well, what we saw happen in Zimbabwe was a hyperinflation. The currency was destroyed, but the debt didn't go away. The debt was there and simply got redenominated, and now, after a hyperinflation that destroyed the currency, Zimbabwe is now experiencing deflation. We saw the same pattern happen in Weimar Germany after World War I. There are other historical examples as well. Now, we talk about these historical examples and talk about potential outcomes and how your assets and your retirement dreams might be affected at our new retirement rules class. If you'd like to attend the new retirement rules class, the cost is just $49. Information is posted on the class at our website, newretirementrules.com. You can also register there. The cost for the class is just $49. I'd encourage you to check it out. You can also get a weekly free subscription to my newsletter, Portfolio Watch, by visiting the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourretirementoutlook.com. That's all the time I have for this week. Hope you got something you can use. We'll talk again next week. Bye.